This is the one. This is the chant that gets me the most. There is only one solution: Intifada revolution. Really, only one solution? Have you ever heard about the two-state solution? Have you ever heard about coexistence? There's many different solutions. Intifada is one of them. It's also the most violent one. It's the bloody one. That's the only solution for you, but it is. It is for them.
That is Shai Davidai speaking during our interview on April 5th. About how aggressive and violent the protests were at that point at the Columbia University campus in New York City 3 weeks ago, and how the university administration just sat around and did nothing. It's only gotten worse since then. It's early Thursday evening in Israel when I record this introduction, so certain aspects of this narrative will be outdated by the time this podcast drops on Friday morning Eastern Time. But that's what big media is for. They can cover how many arrests have been made, the escalating violence and chaos. Talking heads will do their best to impose some sort of big picture perspective on it all, on all the mayhem. But the truth is that we are way over the precipice. This does not happen overnight, even if we've allowed ourselves to think it has. We, particularly in North America, have become complacent. We have come to take our liberal democratic freedoms for granted. We have allowed foreign governments and others with very different views of society and what it should be to incrementally buy and accumulate influence. And they have done so in broad daylight. And many of those interests are particularly hostile to Israel and to Jews. Jewish North Americans, we have confused our professional and business success with acceptance in society. We are no different from what happened almost 100 years ago in Europe. As my late father, who was a Holocaust survivor, said to me several times, "Don't tell me it can't happen again, because it did happen." I have always known in my bones that it will happen, where and when we least expect it, because that's what history has taught us. And that meant, to me, America and Israel. Like Shai Davidai, I am no prophetess. Not at all. But I do pay attention to what is going on around me. And I make a point of learning history and trying to place it into my lived experience. Since Shai Davidai felt compelled to speak out on the Columbia University campus about the pro-Hamas madness, he has become something of a reluctant international celebrity. He has also become something of a pariah among his academic colleagues and the university administration. They just want him to shut up. They've even gone so far as to launch an investigation into his conduct on campus and in the classroom. I'm going to suggest that this is nothing more than an effort to intimidate him into silence. But as Davidai says to me in today's conversation, they picked the wrong Jew. We discussed the increasingly hostile environment for Jewish students and faculty on campus, the callousness of Columbia's administration, the detachment of the mainstream organized Jewish community from the reality of what is going on, the convergence of, quote, progressive, closed quote, woke ideologies with violent Islamism, and how we cannot give up fighting this ignorance that is quickly taking over our academic institutions and societies. Just another walk in the park with Shai Davidai and State of Tel Aviv, Part 2. I'm Vivian Berkovich, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and now living in the very, very hot and steamy, in the midst of a brutal two-day heat wave, State of Tel Aviv. Stay with us.
So, Shai, you've had quite an interesting 6 months. Over this period of time, have the relationships that you have with your faculty colleagues, have they changed? Has the way in which you are able to conduct yourself in the classroom changed? I just want to touch on those sort of the more human side of things, interpersonal side of things.
One of the things people need to know about me And I know it's weird to say this because it seems maybe very different from what we see online and what we're being used to. There's actually no difference between my public persona and there's no public persona. There's Shai Davidai who's on Twitter, there's Shai Davidai on Instagram, there's Shai Davidai in real life. It's all the same person. There's no strategy. I don't have some scheme. It's just me being me. So in class, nothing has changed. I am first and foremost a professor in class. I tell that to my students. This is not the Shai Davidai show. This is not the Jewish Israeli show. I am a professor. My obligation is to you as my students to give you the education that you deserve and you paid for.
Right.
I'll go even one step further. Students want to talk to me about what's happening in the world. I tell them after class, when we leave the room, where we're no longer in this power dynamic of professor and student, we're just two adults speaking. Then I'll tell you what I think. In class, it's not that I don't, I won't. I think that's the contract, the implicit contract between students and professors. But I'm here to teach you, not to tell you what to think. So that hasn't changed. My relationship with my colleagues, completely 180. It's a complete 180. Almost entirely all of my colleagues, just pretend that I'm not there. They know what's going on, obviously. They are CC'd on emails that I get from anti-Semites calling me the worst things under the sun. They are CC'd. I know they're getting these emails and they are not, they don't say a word. They don't speak up for me. They don't stand up for me. They didn't stand up when a anti-Semitic bully from a different university, a different professor attacked me and they didn't speak up then. And I asked them to speak up and I said, even if you disagree with me, none of my colleagues have done anything. They are completely...
Did they interact with you? Did they say, good morning? Hi, Shai, how are you?
The absolute minimum.
Wow.
Some of them maybe not agree. We have to remember, there are two professors in the business school, Columbia Business School, in the marketing department, not in my department, that are currently teaching students who sign on to a letter calling the October 7th massacre a military response. None of my colleagues called them out. The business school dean, who's been privately very supportive, has not called them out. The university has not called them. None of them. These are people, and I was in a room with two of them, the two people, in some seminar. I was like, look me in the eyes and tell me that my daughter's life, if she were murdered, if my wife was raped, that's a military response. Don't hide behind letters. That's what they do. They hide. And almost all of my colleagues are hiding. Academics don't have a backbone. They don't have a moral backbone. But the thing is, yes, it's not just in academia, but academics pretend that they do. And that's the hypocrisy of professors who teach leadership. These are my colleagues who teach leadership. They are teaching the next generation of leaders in the United States of America and abroad. They don't have the backbone to actually preach, to walk the walk, right? They preach, but they don't actually act.
You said that the business school dean, your boss, has been quietly supportive behind the scenes.
Incredible, an incredible human being from the get-go. He gets it. He knows I'm right. He knows I'm right. He's been privately supportive, but publicly, nothing.
Why? I'm sure you've asked him. Why?
I think there's fear. When you deal with the Hitler Youth, when you deal with this pro-Hamas, pro-Islamic Jihad mob, they work like the mafia. And the mafia tells you, if you criticize us, if you try to touch us, we will grow 10 times worse and we will make your life a living hell. So you don't touch them. And that's exactly what we're doing at Columbia. If you try to stop our protest, they will become violent. So don't touch us. Don't criticize us. Don't even look at us.
Has he ever suggested to you, hey, Shai, hold your side and say, maybe cool it or just dial it down?
Yeah. Let me tell you a story. About 2 months ago, a month and a half ago, I get off of a meeting or something. And I look at my phone and it's exploding with messages. Why? Because a neo-Nazi website put my picture and name on their Twitter page and my dean's email saying, contact the dean to fire him. This website has 125,000 followers. I immediately start writing my dean an email saying, sorry, just a heads up. I don't even press send. The dean walks in with the vice dean. And he's chewing my head off. He's, what the hell? Why am I getting all these emails? And I was like, whoa. I realize you were between an anvil and a hard place, but do you think I woke up this morning thinking, ooh, I hope to get on a neo-Nazi website with my face and name. Of course not. Like, we're on the same side here. And then he was like, you know, he just maybe just cool it a little bit, maybe just relax. And I said, why don't you watch the videos of the things I posted yesterday and then tell me? And I don't blame him. He's put in a difficult position, an impossible position. But so am I, right? And then 20 minutes later, he comes back. He says, oh, I saw the video. You're right. It's despicable. He agrees with me. But Americans, Jews and non-Jews, have this mentality of keep your head down. Things will pass. I don't know. I have an Israeli mentality, a Jewish mentality of maybe probably a Jewish-Israeli mentality of like, no, hold your head high up and stare it in the eyes until it will back down. You are not putting your head down until it passes.
That's interesting because I have the same mentality as you and I'm not American. I'm Canadian. And there's one nationality that's known for just stiff upper lip. It's the English in us. Keep your head down. Keep quiet. Don't make waves. Canadians are polite and nice. People are learning otherwise now, but that's the stereotype. I'm glad you got to this point because we're talking about all these things around kind of core issue. We're talking about fear. We're talking about a lack of moral fortitude. We're talking about anger. But in the meantime, we have this very deep, entrenched anti-Semitism, because that's what it is, that's festering and just going viral everywhere. Americans have this idea that we spoke about earlier, you and I, American exceptionalism. In a nutshell, that America is an extraordinary nation, a nation founded on ideas, not based on religion or ethnicity, and that America is really an extraordinary and completely different environment historically from anything that's ever existed before. And I'll just share with you one very brief anecdote of an exchange I had years ago, about 5-6 years ago, with a very well-known American Jewish media personality. And this person was just very agitated when I suggested that American Jews are kind of like the German Jews. They're ignoring what's happening. They're ignoring the early signs. I mean, now we're into kind of full-blown, but there's a buildup. Things don't just happen spontaneously from one day to the next. There is a continuum. And at that time, the person said to me, you're crazy. It was shortly after the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. And they said, look, the cops are on our side. They're protecting us. Fast forward how many years later? 4, 5, 6 years later? Are the cops protecting us?
Yeah, I've heard that argument. And whenever someone says, look, the cops are protecting every synagogue. And I tell them, you're right. But as an academic, forget Jew or Israeli. As a rational academic, I just have to tell you that you're confusing correlation with causation. Cops are there because there is anti-Semitism, not the other way around. What do you think would happen if tomorrow morning, so tonight, it's Shabbat, if tonight the NYPD decided we do not protect any synagogues anymore? What do you think will happen? Two words, dead Jews. That's it. Don't confuse the fact that the cops are there to say there isn't anti-Semitism. The only reason the cops are there is because there is a threat of anti-Semitism. Police forces, understaffed, under-budgeted, why do you think they wouldn't just spend like a police squad outside of every synagogue unless there was an actual threat? The number of bomb calls threatening, it was fake, but still threatening to synagogues across the United States last year is in the hundreds. In the hundred, meaning every Shabbat, dozens and dozens of synagogues across the United States need to evacuate the congregants because someone's calling in a bomb threat. If that is not enough to wake you up, I don't know what is. Now, I don't blame oblivious Jews or non-Jews. I don't blame them. If you asked me on October 6th, I might have been like, yeah, it's a problem, but it's not that big of a problem. I've always thought it was a problem. I don't blame you for not knowing. I blame you for not wanting to know. And that's a difference. Because when the true face is in your face, it punches you in the face, you still refuse to heed to it, then that's on you.
You grew up in Israel. I think you did, I don't know if you did all of your academic studies. You did some of it in the States, I believe.
But I got my graduate degree in the US. Yeah, I moved here after my undergrad and working a little bit.
Israeli-American kind of hybrid, but you grew up in
Israel. I'm not American. I should be transparent. My wife is, my kids are, I'm just Israeli.
So an Israeli in America, some would all say Americanized culturally, because after you live there for a while and your wife's American. So you know, in some ways, an outsider looking in. How do you explain the overconfidence? Or, because it is a choice, the choice to look away, the choice that people make to say, no, it's actually, it's not that bad.
So how do I explain this? I don't know. There's many explanations for something as big. But one thing I would say is it's a lack of education. When you ask Americans, 1492, what if that date tells you? Oh, Columbus. All right, what else? Something else big that happened in the world that year. What about the 80% of Jews that were driven out of Spain that year? Oh, nothing, right? When you ask American about emancipation, what does emancipation mean? Oh, everyone knows it's a proclamation of emancipation, 1862, 63, Abraham Lincoln, about the ending of slavery, an important thing. All right, what is auto-emancipation? No idea. Auto-emancipation, the Zionist idea that the Jews, well, no one's protecting us, so we will need to protect, emancipate ourselves, right? An estimated 30% of Americans get to college without ever taking a lesson on the Holocaust. Now, I don't think you should learn about the Holocaust as a Jewish thing. You need to learn about the Holocaust as probably the most important thing that happened in the 20th century. And you choose, and this is not a mistake, when you choose not to educate people and you focus them only on American history and only on American stories, then of course this is what you get. You get people that believe that America is exceptional. Don't confuse your lack of knowledge of the world with belief of, and by the way, it's extremely important. The United States of America has given so much to the world. That doesn't make you exceptional, but it just still makes you a really good country. And I've chosen to live here. And in a way, I love the United States of America as an idea. In practice, got a lot of work to do, but as an idea, I love this.
Yeah, there's a lot to love about it. There's a lot.
Are you concerned with what is going on in Israel? This is not just another crisis. State of Tel Aviv is committed to delivering superb and candid analysis, and we're offering a limited-time subscription special, a 33% discount from the regular fee of $90 annually. 1 year for only $60. Stay informed and stay connected with State of Tel Aviv. We are a reader-supported enterprise. If you value our work, please subscribe. It makes a huge difference. stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. Now, back to the podcast.
The American Jews, you've got a lot of Jewish students probably on Columbia campus. You've become something of a lightning rod. I expect that there are quite a few parents who've reached out to you. But these parents call you and they must be freaked out. And yeah, and like, what do you say?
First of all, I validate them. So no, I'll be honest. The first thing I do is listen. I just listen because I mostly get calls and emails from parents of undergrads and parents of high schoolers going to college. And many of them just don't feel like they're being listened to by anyone in the university. So I just listen. Every time I get an email, sometimes it takes me a month, but I reply. I've been on emails, CC'd on emails where a parent emailed the president of the university and me.
Wow.
And I'm the only one that replied. They get an email, they get a reply from Shai Davidai, but not from Inu Shafiq. The first thing I do is just validate them and listen to them. Show them like, no, there are people here that are decent people that are listening to you. And the second thing I tell them is, you're right. It's not a safe place. None of these colleges are safe for your kids right now. They should be prepared for a fight. But hey, I'm from Israel. I'm used to the fact that there's no safe place. There's safer places. But the idea of danger is part of your existence. You don't run away from danger. You don't run towards danger. You learn to deal with danger and arm yourself. In universities, that means arm yourself with knowledge, arm yourself with debating skills and argumentative skills, and arm yourself with a community of other like-minded Jews and non-Jews who will support you.
Are you finding that it's primarily Jewish parents who are reaching out to you, or is there a mix?
Jewish people reach out to me. The difference in emails is very palatable. So I get a lot. I can't even tell you how many emails I get on a daily basis. But when I get from Jewish people, mostly frustration and fear, and its parents, its students, its grandparents, regular Jewish folk. When I get emails from non-Jews, it's confusion and anger. They're just emailing like, how can this be? And I email them back saying, I don't know. But the truth is, I don't care. I know it's not academic of me to say this, but I don't care why this happens. I just care that it does and to make sure that it doesn't. I'll stop this. And then 20 years from now, historians can have a field day on explaining this. I don't have the privilege to sit back and start thinking of how could this be, to expose this and fight this, fighting for this moderation and peacefulness. So I understand people's natural inclination to look for the culprit and it be, and the easiest way is to say it's this population, but it really is not populations. We have nose-ringed, purple-haired white kids from Wisconsin who have never even heard the name Chan Yunis or Rafla before October 7th. Will not be able to name more than three cities in Israel. And all of a sudden, they are clad in keffiyehs and calling for destruction of the Zionist entity. They're not Muslim, they're not Arab, they're hateful. It's complete lack of, I don't even know what it is. Honestly, I don't know what it is. But I do want to say this. I think what we're seeing is a lot of ideas that in their essence are really good and pure ideas. And they have been co-opted by ideologues, shifted to nefarious reasons. The idea of critical race theory, if you look like originally, it's the idea of situating the America's past of slavery and Jim Crow and the civil rights movement in a more general context of race in society. That is an interesting and a good idea. The moment this was co-opted into an ideology, oppression Olympics and oppressed oppressor and white supremacy and all that, that is taking a good idea and completely co-opting it.
Right. And that is what we're living. That's the moment we're living through. That's what's been done.
And by the way, that's what we're doing to democracy now. No one's going to argue that democracy is not a good idea. Democracy is an incredible idea, but it's being co-opted, or free speech. It's part of democracy here. It's being co-opted to say, let's use free speech to dismantle democracy. Yesterday, we had a large, violent, and unauthorized pro-Hamas, pro-Islamic Jihad protest on Columbia's campus. You can go on my Twitter and see horrific videos. You can also see a recording of the senior vice president of the university who was there and refused to do anything about it.
I listened to that audio that you posted on Twitter of your exchange yesterday, and it's unreal.
It's jarring. But one of the things that the problematic thing about this is that they went around the rules by incorporating a union. Unions are allowed to protest because that's the importance of unions. And I'm a union supporter. I think unions play an important role in society. The protests had nothing to do with unions. Hamas doesn't allow unions in Gaza. You know where there are unions? Israel. But the protest was a pro-Hamas organization. But they take the good idea of union and they ruin it. They took the great idea of feminism and they ruin it by refusing to acknowledge the sexual crimes. They take the great idea of LGBTQ equality, which I think is so extremely important, and they ruin it by fighting for the people who are executing gay and lesbian and trans individuals. My concern, it's not a Jewish concern, it's a society concern. They're not going after just after Jews. They're going after the ideas of liberalism, LGBTQ rights, union rights. They're going after all of this. They're ruining all of this. And when the dust settles, I don't know what will remain.
What was violent about the union gathering yesterday when you confronted the SVP of Columbia? What happened?
I mean, all the chants. So first of all, I confronted the senior vice president just for the fact that this was an unauthorized protest and public safety refuses to do anything. And you can hear the senior vice president say, wait and see. And I told him, wait and see what? They're breaking the rules already just by having a protest. What are you waiting to see? But we all know what they're waiting to see. They're waiting to see a seriously injured Jew. And I am the kind of Jew who will say, no, the rhetoric is violent And I'm not going to wait for someone to throw the first punch and then to say, oh, you're right. The rhetoric was violent. The writing is on the wall. I'm saying right now, the writing is on the wall. Don't wait for it to acknowledge it's too late. And that's a problem. And you can see them full garb, Hamas garb, dancing and singing Intifada right now, Intifada, globalize the Intifada. There is only one solution. This is the one. This is the chant that gets me the most. There is only one solution, Intifada revolution. Really? Only one solution? Have you ever heard about the two-state solution? Have you ever heard about coexistence? There's many different solutions. Intifada is one of them. It's also the most violent one. It's the bloody one. That the only solution for you? But it is. It is for them. That's
and so this is what was going on the Columbia campus yesterday. And that's when you went over to the SVP and recorded him.
I went over to him before things got out of hand. But yeah.
Okay.
And they knew, the university knew in advance that this is happening. Yeah. They send out a message saying today there's going to be an unauthorized protest. They knew this is happening. They intentionally refused to do anything about it. Mm-hmm.
I do want to get into the investigation that is ongoing into your conduct. When did this start? When was it initiated? Tell us a bit about what's going on. What's the process? Yeah. What are you being investigated for?
I was notified early February that I'm being investigated by the Office of Equal Opportunity and Affirmative Action for harassing students based on shared ancestry. The two things that I have not done is harass students and focus on people based on shared ancestry. And the reason I say this is everything's out in the open. I do not hide behind masks. I do not hide behind kafir. I do not hide behind aliases. You can go and see online everything that I've done.
But hang on. I just want to break this down because I want to make sure I understand it. But you're being investigated for harassing students on the basis of shared ancestry.
So we're saying that I am harassing students because basically Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, I don't know what the shared ancestry is.
I don't know. Okay. Shared ancestry is like a new one for me.
And I tell everyone, go and judge for yourself. And you can see, one, I never talk about students. I talk about student organizations. And two, I only focus on the ideology, the pro-Hamas, pro-Islamic Jihad ideology. I have never said anything about Palestinians, Muslims, or any other group. When I have said, it was how I abhor Islamophobia, how I abhor anti-Palestinian and anti-Arab prejudice, how I am in favor of the Palestinian people. And the only thing is that I oppose terrorism. And I've been very clear about this. So this is not really an investigation as much as a silencing campaign.
An intimidation campaign. I think it's extraordinary that you actually don't really understand what it is you're being investigated for.
So I can tell you, they have to tell me what I'm being investigated for. So
okay.
They didn't. And when my lawyers said, hey, you have to tell us, why are you breaking your own rules? And they sent me a list of tweets and you can go and see everything online. I can't tell you all the exact date, but it starts on October 18th in that video. I'm being investigated for that viral video where I say that rape is never okay. That's what I'm being investigated for.
Hang on. So the university's investigating you for a whole, I'm sure they've got an inventory of tweets, but beginning with the one where you say rape is just not okay.
Yeah. And I even say it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or Christian or Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu or atheist or anything else, rape is never okay. So I even explicitly say this is not about who you are. It's not about religion. It's about humanity. And that's what I'm being investigated for because the university doesn't like the fact that there's a Jew speaking out and calling out its shameful behavior.
Absolutely. You're shining the light. And the office that's investigating you is?
Equal Opportunity and Affirmative Action.
So they must have a mandate and rules and protocols and all kinds of things. In order to investigate you, does a complaint have to be made by someone?
Yes. They receive complaints. They can be anonymous complaints. And they have a vetting process. And after a while, if they decide whether to investigate or not, they could at any moment have decided this is a complete political weaponization of our office and we will not investigate. And instead, they thought, ooh, good idea. Let's weaponize our office to shut down this one Jewish professor who's speaking up. Their only calculation mistake is that they messed with the wrong Jew.
That's my line.
That this Jew will not back down because you're not going to scare me from speaking up. This is bigger than my job. This is bigger than my livelihood. I'm not speaking up for my job. I'm speaking up for my people. If you don't understand it, Colombia, then you made a mistake.
But as you said, Shai, as you said earlier, you're speaking up for your people, but you're speaking up for humanity. It's so much bigger than, yeah.
Of course. And I will say the one thing that Colombia has been successful is this investigation silenced everyone else. Because no one else will want to speak up now. Because they know that if you speak up, the university comes after you.
So what's the timeline for this investigation and what are the possible outcomes?
It's supposed to end somewhere in a few months. Possible outcomes is from being fired to being exonerated. I have told my lawyers and have made this public, I will not take anything short of complete and public exoneration. I believe that the university thinks we'll just give him a slap on the wrist, tell him you need to do some sensitivity training. I'm all for sensitivity training, but everyone should be taking it, including Joseph Mossad. Joseph, October 7th was awesome, Mossad, right? All of us should be taking, and that's important. But I will not rest until I'm exonerated because that's what innocent people do.
Right.
Guilty people take a plea deal, or innocent people, they wait until they fight it out because I've done nothing wrong.
Have there been any community organizations, Jewish, civil liberties, anything that have been helpful and supportive of you in this?
Amazing organizations. I'm not going to name all of them just because I don't remember, but Stand With Us, B'nai B'rith, End Jew Hatred, incredible organization. MACA, I don't know if you've heard about MACA, Mothers Against Campus Antisemitism. It was started after October 7th. We already have 60,000 members. I just spoke yesterday with them. The Brandeis Center, the Lawfare Project, obviously my lawyers at Kasowitz that are doing it all pro bono.
What about the ACLU?
I should say the ADL. The ACLU is one of those organizations that have taken a good idea to the extreme, civil liberties, and are now fighting for the pro-Hamas, pro-Islamic Jihad organizations. The New York chapter of ACLU has filed a lawsuit in favor of the pro-Hamas crowd, the pro-Hamas mob on campus. So again, this is what I've been telling every Jew that I meet here. Stop looking up for someone else to fight for you. The ACLU is not going to help you. Trump's not going to help you. Biden's not going to help you. It's stop looking for heroes. We are the people that invented Superman. We are the people that invented the golem. And that's because we are not going to wait for someone else to save us. We have to save ourselves. We invented auto-emancipation because no president is going to come and emancipate us.
It's just every organization that you mentioned is Jewish related, has a Jewish base. And that's why I asked about the ACLU. I was hoping that I was going to hear about some non-Jewish or just a general NGO.
There are many good organizations that just don't realize yet that this is their fight. They think it's a Jewish problem or an Israeli problem. They don't understand it's an American problem. They don't, like, there are three hostages, American hostages. And no one, like, the fact that the New York Times doesn't have that on their headline page every day. Today is day 182. Every day, three American hostages in Gaza. The fact that they're not, that's a shanda. That's a huge shame. And as long as I'm alive, I'm going to remind this to every person I meet from the New York Times that they are complicit in not in Israel's problems or a Jewish problem, the fact in losing American lives.
I can tell you in the period leading up to Christmas in Toronto, the pro-Hamas thugs were going into malls and it was that Zara moment where they decided that Zara was the root of all evil, right? Because they have a Jewish or graphic designer or something. Anyhow, so they were in the malls and then they thought, oh, there's Santa. Let's scare little children. All the little kids want to go sit on Santa's lap. And they targeted Santa in malls in Toronto and Ottawa and made little kids cry. And that was when non-Jewish Canadians woke up a bit and said, WTF is going on here? Why are you doing this? It's Christmas. And the Hamas people said, how dare you celebrate Christmas at a time like this? You should be picketing Zara or marching on Zara with us. I'm seeing in Canada a shift. People are getting it's very bad in parts of Canada and very aggressive. And I think people are starting to appreciate exactly what you're saying. We have to start to step up. This isn't just the Jews, right? This is everybody.
In New York City, one of these pro-Hamas picketed the cancer ward of Memorial Kitting Hospital.
Wow.
because the big donor is not a Jew, but a non-Jew who supports Israel. And he gave them $400 million, which is a great thing for a cancer ward. And they protested the cancer ward. And what I want every American and every Canadian and everyone in the world to understand, this is the war on terror.
Absolutely.
War on terror started in Afghanistan, and it's now happening in Toronto and New York City and Berkeley. Yeah. And if you think it's anything other than that, then you are either badly mistaken, horribly naive, or a supporter of terror.
Shai, I'm sure that this period has been very difficult for you and your family. And I just want to say, I don't want to ask you about that and don't want to pry or be voyeuristic, but I'm going to make the assumption that it's been very stressful. And thank you for your courage. And thank you for your moral fortitude and just being clear, being decent, and not bowing to the pressure.
I'll be honest with you. There's nothing unique about me. There's nothing unique. No one should know the name Shai Davidai. It doesn't matter. What is amazing is the community behind me. When I go on social media and I see other people, Jews and non-Jews, fighting for me and for the message, I'm so extremely grateful. And that's how I keep going. So I just ask people, like, how do you want to help? People are like, how can we help you? It's like, look, the best thing right now is follow me on social media, Twitter and Instagram, and help amplify the message. Forget who I am. Don't even retweet me. Make your own messages. But who cares about Shai Davidai? No one should. Who cares about the message? Everyone should. And that's what I ask people. I realize there's a lot of fear for people who are speaking up. But what I also remind them is, man, what a rush it is to speak up. When you speak up for moral truth and you see that nothing happened, it's okay. Then you get this high that is an unadulterated high. It's not drugs or alcohol, or it's just like a good feeling of standing up for what's right. So even if you're afraid, try it, see what happens, and you'll see that you feel good. And it doesn't have to be in public media. You can speak up to a friend who shared false news and just said, hey, that is BS. Take that down and I'll explain why. And you'll feel amazing. You'll feel angry, you'll feel frustrated, but you'll also feel good about yourself. So thank you so much for having me, and Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. And thank you so much for being so generous with your time. And keep up the good fight, Shai.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the State of Tel Aviv and Beyond podcast. We'll keep the dispatches coming as frequently as we can. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment, rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can check out our full library of articles and podcasts at our website, stateoftelaviv.com. State of Tel Aviv is an independent media venture, and we rely on subscribers to support our work. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, please consider taking the plunge today. Each person really does make a huge difference, especially in these very challenging times in Israel. It is important that you stay informed and current and seek out a range of perspectives. This is a pivotal moment in Israeli history. It is not a time to be passive and disengaged. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm Vivian Berkovich, signing off from deep inside the State of Tel Aviv.